You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 75 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Anthroposophy and the Natural Sciences. And it's got eight lectures. Some are lectures, some are discussions. I've just called them all lectures. Translated by Sabine Seiler. This is Lecture 4, entitled Natural Science and Anthroposophy, given in Zurich on June 4th, 1921. Jakob Hugentobler. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you warmly to this lecture. With this lecture, we want to present to you again something positive from the field of anthroposophical spiritual science in response to what has spread so widely these days as criticism, most often negative criticism. If you keep your eyes open these days and open yourself to the world around you with deeper understanding, you will see that in all areas of culture, in the sciences, religion, and the arts, new phenomena appear. You will see new beginnings that look like something wants to emerge, but has not yet found its true path for this. Anthroposophical spiritual science now tries to reveal the roots of everything that appears here as a healthy new development in its beginnings. Anthroposophical spiritual science wants to show how we can penetrate to a deeper spiritual sphere, and how out of this spiritual sphere something can grow in which all that makes itself felt nowadays in so many separate movements can be unified again. It is thanks to this possibility of a deeper knowledge that anthroposophical spiritual science claims to extend to all areas of life, to advance into all areas of life with its new knowledge. It is this spirit which wants to and must be active to stimulate the entire cultural life of our time that we want to talk about here today. Thus, the fact that anthroposophical spiritual science extends to all areas of life must no longer be met, as was so often the case in the past, with indignation, astonishment, or surprise, and with the allegation that it is presumptuous and arrogant. Indeed, it is true that anthroposophical spiritual science makes the claim to be a truly comprehensive worldview. The lecture today will be presented to you on the basis of such a real inclusive worldview. We are also offering you here an opportunity to participate in Eurythmy courses. Eurythmy is a new movement, art, inaugurated by Dr. Rudolf Steiner. It is based on anthroposophical spiritual science, and this new art of Eurythmy will be taught in single individual courses. In addition, we are offering you the opportunity to enter more deeply into anthroposophical spiritual science in this way by attending introductory courses that will also be held here in Zurich. If you are interested, you can sign up with your name and address. You will find all other information in the programs that have been handed out. Rudolf Steiner. Ladies and gentlemen, the distorted picture of anthroposophy that is so often presented is then opposed in such a way that very little of what anthroposophy essentially represents is addressed. This is because many people today still think this anthroposophy is something that in a way stands in the middle between science, in the strict sense of the word, on the one hand, and the various religious views on the other. To point out how inaccurate these assessments are, which place the anthroposophy meant here in that shaky position, I want to talk in this introductory lecture today above all about the sources and actual origins of anthroposophical research. And in this regard, I must first of all point out the following. Much as it is indeed true that what emerges in anthroposophy touches the religious feelings and sentiments of people, this anthroposophy itself has not originally grown out of some religious impulse. Rather, it has developed out of the natural sciences of our time, out of a scientific worldview. From certain standpoints, this may sound paradoxical. However, precisely in order to characterize the scientific spirit of anthroposophy properly, the fact that it originated in the natural sciences must be explicitly and emphatically pointed out. In turning to anthroposophy, people are generally imbued with the realization that humanity owes its greatest achievements, its greatest powers, to what we call the insights of the natural sciences. And I want to admit that I myself am of the opinion that no other spirit should prevail in anthroposophy except for the one that has been developed and schooled in the scientific research of our time. Above all, that is a spirit which has come to know the conscientious, exacting methods of observation and experimentation, and of the scientific thinking characteristic of our time. However, when we talk about a kind of scientific preparation for anthroposophy, we are not so much taking into consideration the results, the triumphant achievements of the modern natural sciences, but more the spirit of schooling and training we attain when we learn to work scientifically, that is, through experimentation and observation, and to gain in a serious way a scientific view of the beings of the world and the phenomena of the world. Now, as it has turned out in the course of modern scientific development, there has increasingly arisen in this scientific research the sense for the exclusive significance of the sensory world of facts, for what is founded upon solid facts can be observed by the senses, this observation, in turn, being enhanced through the use of instruments. Only what is built on this foundation is considered a true basis of modern scientific research. And the further science has advanced, the more people have turned away from using their thinking, methodical thinking, to rise above that world of facts. Instead, people have increasingly shifted to viewing facts through experimentation, in such a way that these facts speak for themselves in their mutual connections. And in this way, scientists arrive at the laws of nature, as they are called. Of course, it was not so long ago that people, in dealing with facts, did not shy away from the path that leads from these facts to more or less bold hypotheses. In our time, these hypotheses have grown into conceptual systems. And this has led to insights regarding the universe, for example. Today, we are living in a time when people have begun to have doubts about these hypotheses that initially seemed so plausible. For example, people have doubts about the hypothesis regarding the origin of the world as set forth by Kant and Laplace. That hypothesis now is considered to be on shaky ground, even though, on the other hand, people concede that in order to come to any satisfying overview of the sensory world of phenomena, such hypotheses are to some degree indispensable. The above remarks more or less characterize the first point. Of course, I could only sketch out in a few sentences what people encounter today when they embark on researching the field of the natural sciences. But the second point is perhaps even more important today. We find today that as a result of the precision we expect from the natural sciences, a certain basic education in mathematics has become indispensable, even in the descriptive sciences. In the natural sciences, a definition has recently gained currency that seems a bit paradoxical and a bit extreme, but it shows, nevertheless, in what frame of mind people carry out their thinking in the natural sciences. The definition I am referring to is the following: that which exists is that which can be measured. Such a definition highlights the extent to which scientific thinkers are completely in their element when they have attained the art of geometry and the exact measuring that proceeds from geometry, arithmetic, and other branches of mathematics. This mathematical training is in a way something that people must bring with them as a prerequisite for successful scientific research. Now, what I want to say to you today about anthroposophy has less to do with the individual scientific results that can be achieved through measuring, counting, and so on, and more with the particular mood of soul experienced by researchers, when equipped with the transparent fabric of ideas from arithmetic, geometry, and algebra, as well as with ideas from the world of differential or integral equations, and even of synthetic geometry, and so on. When thus equipped with all those ideas and concepts, which are indeed produced in the human personality itself, the researcher then faces the outer world of phenomena and finds the following. With what I have developed basically out of my own inner being and put into formulas, into structures, with all of that, I can now delve into what my senses offer me. And one will also feel the following. With what I have, in a sense, spun out of my own being, I can comprehend and permeate everything that appears to me as an entirely foreign element in the outer world of facts. This confluence of the mathematical, which we attain in full clarity with free inner activity of the will that permeates everything and then manifests as construct and form, as formula, this confluence of the mathematical with what we encounter in the outside world, and what in a sense comes to us from the outside, this is what makes up the special soul mood of those who approach the world in accordance with today's exact sciences. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to point out here something that we learn in this way in working with mathematics, particularly in developing algebraic formulas or other formulas or geometric shapes. I want to point out that it is possible for us, in looking backward, to observe ourselves and see how we conduct ourselves in this working with mathematics, and how we can, first of all, come to a certainty, albeit only a formal one, of the inner truth of these formulas and shapes. This is what we can see, and in this way we arrive at a kind of insight into the psychological process that runs its course while we work with mathematics. True, in the ascendancy of the natural sciences, we have, as I'd like to say, become complacent about this application of mathematics. People have hardly ever considered the psychological process involved. But precisely, if we want to really advance to an understanding of nature and want to move beyond purely natural scientific research, then it becomes necessary that we look more closely at the processes in our soul. That is, we must look at what happens in us as we develop our mathematical abilities. And why is that? Let us look at the process that takes place as we observe the outer world, or, through experiments, observe it systematically, and then understand it with mathematics. When we observe this process of scientific research in our own person, as the subject of investigation, so to speak, it is not only a matter of studying something scientifically, but rather at the same time, we also train ourselves consciously to comprehend the truth that is possible only through such research and study. Ladies and gentlemen, you see, anthroposophy as we understand it here had its starting point in such studies. Firstly, of this scientific research method as such, and secondly, of a perception of such inner research activity. And this view, this inner view, will be our standard for measuring everything that claims to be or wants to be anthroposophy. I freely and openly admit, we have within us an original sense for the truth. Thus, many people, when they hear of the results that have been achieved in the field of anthroposophy, are to a certain extent inwardly convinced of anthroposophy. And yet, insofar as this really happens due to a certain elementary sense for truth, it is still the case, on the other hand, that those who are qualified to pronounce judgments and to do research in the field of anthroposophy are only those who have undergone the above-mentioned training and self-observation based on scientific research. After all, The appealing nature of the anthroposophical findings makes it very easy to fall into a certain dilettantism, which in turn attracts more dilettantes. But this dilettantism was not part of the origin of anthroposophy and is not inherent in it. It has nothing to do with anthroposophy, as it is to appear in the world in our time. This anthroposophy, as I have described it, takes care that any kind of dilettantism stays far away from it. On the contrary, anthroposophy takes pains to make sure that it can give an account of how it arrives at its results that would stand up to even the strictest scientific scrutiny of our time. For that reason, I call what appears in anthroposophy not a belief of any kind, but something that can indeed stand next to contemporary science as an equal, and can imbue science. The mind that has been trained in what is demanded of science today, the spirit that underlies the recognized sciences, is the same scientific spirit as the one that underlies anthroposophy. However, precisely at the moment when we are imbued with this scientific spirit and look back from the purely mathematical exposition of outer facts to the living research, to what is developing when we leave the external facts behind and carry this science further in our soul, at that moment, when we look back in this way to what remains of this science for us as human beings, then we initially encounter a great central problem, one that in its gigantic size can actually be felt only by those who have schooled themselves in this scientific approach. The problem I am referring to is the problem of human freedom. Natural science and the philosophy dependent on it, at least it is dependent on it today, cannot help but start from what is so deeply interwoven with things that we have to call it necessity. With a frame of mind prevalent in the natural sciences these days, it is impossible to have any starting point other than necessity. And indeed, it is precisely the ideal of science to understand what we encounter in the world around us as a system of inwardly, necessarily connected beings and facts. By indulging in this way of doing scientific research, we do not come at all close to the immediate experience we encounter in the inner fact of human freedom. We just cannot come close to understanding it in that way. And so we face the significant question that leads us to a chasm in our knowledge, a knowledge abyss. Freedom as a direct experience is given to us. Thus, by casting our mathematical net of knowledge over the facts of the natural sciences, and thereby developing a picture of the world, we do not approach that experience which cannot be denied as a direct experience, freedom. If you will allow me to interweave something personal here, I want to point out that I myself already encountered, as early as the 1880s, precisely on the basis of my studies in spiritual science, that the scientific necessity and significance of objective research is not to be denied, but must be acknowledged. And I also encountered the problem of freedom. And in my book titled The Philosophy of Freedom, published in 1893, I try to come to terms with philosophy in the way a person thinking along the lines of natural science needed to in those days. Now, if we already had a fully developed psychology or science of the soul set up in accordance with our scientific needs, something we do not have, it would be much easier for us to talk about what I have to say in this moment. Regarding the science of the soul, there have been peculiar developments in recent times. To characterize the fate of psychology, I usually have to point to an excellent thinker of our time who died here a year ago on the Zürichberg, namely Franz Brentano. Around the middle of the 19th century, Franz Brentano was completely immersed in scientific thinking. And when he first formed his theses in Würzburg, at the beginning of his lectureship, one of his main theses was the following, namely that in the study of the soul, no other method should be applied than the one that is also used in the outer natural sciences. In 1874, Franz Brentano then published the first volume of his title, Psychology from an Empirical Standpoint. And when that first volume of the series appeared in the spring of that year, he promised that the second volume would follow in the fall, and then four more volumes in quick succession in the subsequent years. In the meantime, Franz Brentano has died. No continuation of that first volume has ever appeared. When you read that first volume of Brentano's Psychology with an open mind, you will understand, just based on the way and manner in which that psychology appeared, why there was no sequel. As Franz Brentano explains in that first volume openly and honestly, if we stop where he stopped, we will have to concede that we actually know nothing. When we look at how concepts and mental pictures are interconnected, and how they are related to memory, when we look at the social nature of our ideas and mental pictures and so on, and apply the purely scientific method to all of this, then what we have is not a substitute for the kind of psychology that Plato and Aristotle had been hoping for. Indeed, such an approach could not substitute for a psychology that is also able to address what we have to call the eternal in the human being, or as Franz Brentano put it, quote, what remains after the dissolution of the body, close quote. Franz Brentano wanted to solve this problem, it is popularly called the immortality problem, by following the methods of the natural sciences and psychology. That is what he grappled with. He did not want to enter, and I want to say this emphatically, into that area I have described to you here as anthroposophy. He thought that was not sufficiently scientific. And because he was an honest researcher, he simply could not continue writing. Combining honesty in the realm of psychology with the spirit of scientific research is possible only if one is able to develop along the lines of that continuation of scientific thinking which anthroposophical spiritual science demands. The fact that Franz Brentano could not advance to a conclusion with his psychology is living proof that we do not have an actual psychology today. If we had a psychology, an actual psychology, we would already be able to see certain things differently than we usually do today. And in this connection, I want to point out above all the following. When we are active in the natural sciences, organizing scientific facts into laws, then integrating these laws into our intellect, so that in a sense we carry within us what we have discovered through outer observation and experimentation, then we will see that the more we move away from external facts and work only inwardly with our intellect, which has proven to be so excellent when guided by experiment and observation, the more we continue working with this intellect, the more we will realize that none of this satisfies us in the long term. In other words, the more we enter into the thinking that forms hypotheses, which works well in natural scientific research, the more strongly we will feel that in the long run, we cannot be satisfied with any of this. That is, the more we freely engage in the thinking that can be applied very well and successfully in scientific research, the more we form such thought hypotheses, the more we will arrive at something unsatisfactory. And what is so dissatisfying shows itself essentially throughout the whole development of the sciences. Looking at how the various hypotheses were drawn up, such as hypotheses about the nature of light, electricity, gravity, and so on, we see that these hypotheses are again and again replaced by other, newer ones. And those who insist on not taking the standpoint that by now we are, quote, grand and have come so very far, close quote, will admit, on the basis of the feelings they have when constructing hypotheses, The hypotheses we have formed recently will be replaced by others in the course of time. We are now in the midst of replacing, to a certain extent, the old hypothesis concerning light with another one based on electric phenomena. Clearly, we are entering a realm where we form hypotheses based on what our intellect can attain in terms of natural laws, from the observation of the external world, and from outer experimentation. We are entering a realm where this intellect, in a sense, meets something fluid, something that does not evoke within us the feeling that we are arriving at something real with these intellectual constructs, which we formulate in hypotheses, and which, even though, if they were to have any value at all, they would need to point to something real, to something existent, cannot actually arrive at something existent. Now, drawing on this empirical perspective, and equipped with the impartial observation of the inner soul facts, namely, of the will, whoever studies that element in the soul which comprises the fact of freedom will find it in wonderful harmony with the impossibility of arriving at hypotheses that contain the same necessity we possess when we classify and systematize the phenomena of nature with our thinking. We will then feel, when we try with that kind of thinking to approach our soul life and to develop only hypotheses in that soul life, we are essentially swimming in a fluid. We find nothing solid to butt up against in our soul life. And that is wonderfully in line with the fact that the impulse that can be active without being ruled by necessity, the impulse that can truly move freely, is rooted in the soul life. I would like to say that through our external research in the natural sciences, we come to a region of our soul life that shows us, trying to extend necessity into that region, will fail also in theory, and we will not come to any satisfaction, not even in theory. We come up against something in our soul life where freedom is rooted, where we can indeed experience freedom. To correctly delimit this area of freedom from the other areas of the surveillable world, we must understand that as long as we remain in the necessity of the surveillable world, we cannot actually approach with this necessity what we experience inwardly when we are in the region of freedom. I think that precisely a psychology that is able to hold up under the current scientific requirement for exactness would have to point to the special kind of inner satisfaction that we have when playing with hypotheses and when harmonizing with what we now experience inwardly, in the soul, when we experience the fact of inner freedom. I want to draw your attention particularly to the following. I am not talking here about any methods or any theories regarding freedom, but about the fact of freedom, which we simply encounter when we delve impartially into the very life of the soul itself. And then, when we are able to do this, when, equipped with the spirit of true science, we approach ourselves, not going outward, but going toward ourselves, we come to the limit of where the scientific way of thinking still suffices, and where we can transition to what can be experienced in ourselves as freedom. This is where we come to the point of feeling the justification of anthroposophy. Initially, by demonstrating its scientific character, anthroposophy must begin with that experience of the not being able to approach freedom, with what has led to such great theoretical and practical triumphs in the external world, namely with the natural sciences. Now we are standing in this experience of freedom. If we meet this experience not with abstract concepts, but inwardly as an inner fact, if we can experience it ever more intimately, then in our inner experience of the soul that is flooded, pulsing, with the experience of freedom, we know the following. Indeed, we cannot get in there with the thoughts the external natural laws give us. But if we as human beings really want to meet life, stand in life, for example, if we have ideals, if we know the true demands life makes on us, so that we take hold of it in this or that endeavor, then we know we do not stand in this sphere of freedom without thoughts. We take our position in this sphere of freedom by developing a free thinking that is initially only an inner activity of the soul that is not led by external observation or experiment. Instead, as a progressing inner impulse, it begins as a self-creative process in the soul. This is the kind of thinking I have called pure thinking in my title, Philosophy of Freedom. In a sense, that kind of thinking forms the contents of consciousness, when we have trained this consciousness in the way I have outlined just now. But when we move within this kind of thinking, we can remember the concept of being, the concept of reality, which we have acquired in the outer world, in particular in the outer world that has been scientifically investigated, that is, the outer world that the natural sciences offer us. Let's take this concept of reality. Initially, it need not be particularly clear, but just the notion that settles in us, in our immediate outer contact, and also in scientific contact with the outer world. Let's take that concept, that notion of reality, on the one hand. And on the other hand, let's take what we experience consciously by being active in free thinking. And you will see that then something arises in the soul, something I could call basic law or experience. Something arises of which we have to confess, I think, but in thinking, I am not. That is, in thinking, I am not the way I have come to know existence in the outer world. And we are faced with the significant sentence, I think, therefore I am not. Ladies and gentlemen, this is what we must attain first for our consciousness. And that is why it is so difficult to explain for our times what the actual starting point is for the scientific character of anthroposophy. For as most of you know, the modern philosophy is still more or less consciously based on the proposition of Descartes, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. That is, modern philosophy is still based on the great error of believing that in thinking we grasp anything of reality, of such a reality as we have pictured to ourselves initially in the imagination. Instead, we have to admit that what arises when we are thinking is the realization that we are thinking in freedom. That is the experience of non-reality, an experience that, at the same time, is an experience of thinking and also of willing, a pure experience of willing, an experience of wanting and seeking. Ladies and gentlemen, this experience is of tremendous significance for the life of the soul. The fact is that we should actually dwell for some time meditatively in this experience until we feel, in a way, that the I, capital, is hollowed out, and we admit, I think, and in my thinking, that's where my I lives. It is as though I were looking at a colored wall in the midst of which there is a black circle. There is darkness there, no light. Still I see the black circle, I see the black circle within the light. I reach self-awareness in my ordinary life, and in my self-awareness have to admit to myself that when I am thinking, I am not looking into a reality, but rather, if I may put it this way, I am looking into the black circle. That is, I am looking into the not light, which is darkness. And as I look there, I believe that I actually see myself, because within the contents of my awareness there is a gap, a recess left for an I, capital. It is precisely because there is a nothing in the contents of my consciousness, and because I see this non-existence in existence, that in my ordinary thinking, I believe myself initially to be an I. This is a basic fact of psychology and philosophy. Of course, much water will flow under the bridge, before philosophers will take the plunge and enter into this analysis that is necessary. Well, I can only hint at the matter here, can only sketch out what is there. Much will still be explained in very long psychological, philosophical treatises before such an analysis will be undertaken. You see, once we have arrived at the understanding that in the I think, we are initially looking into the emptiness of the inner world, then we also come to realize that something is active there, something that is of the nature of the will. And then we have finally reached the correct starting point for inner methodical anthroposophical research. And this inner methodical anthroposophical research consists in this: beginning with what we have experienced within ourselves of the nature of thinking in the sphere of freedom, having then studied the I think, therefore I am not, in the sense of the existence of beings of the outer world, by letting this work on us, by inwardly grasping, as I would like to put it, this atom of the being of the will, we can then enter the soul mood from which there begins the meditation we need in order to arrive at a true inner perception. People may brand as heresy what takes its place in the world as anthroposophical method, and may misrepresent it by portraying it as something inferior, as people often call things inferior in the field of experiments, pragmatism, and so on. In all the fields of various superstitions, people may misrepresent, as I said, what the spiritual scientist develops by starting from a solid philosophical foundation. But what is being developed there, in terms of meditative methods, is nothing less than a further development of those inner forces of the soul that are present when we engage in mathematics, forces that have led to such great and significant results when applied in the external natural sciences. When we have learned this, then what lives in our soul as activity when we engage in mathematics, that is, when we have immersed ourselves in this peculiar, scientifically developed form of creativity, then we can further develop it by, in a sense, reproducing what appears in our memory, so that this memory initially is for us a kind of guiding impulse for our life. We have such guiding impulses for our life in this form because what appeared as external events at a certain point in life, namely during our childhood, is transformed into inner experiences. In a sense, we can always draw up from the unfathomable depths of our soul parts of what we experienced in the form of images. But we can also distinguish between standing directly within an experience, as we lived through it 10 years ago, for example, and recalling in the present moment what we experienced back then. No matter how vivid those pictures are, the essential thing in this life of memory is that through our inner picturing, we make what we experienced fleetingly into something permanent, however, such that we cannot at first determine what is happening in the depths of the soul, or perhaps also in the depths of the living organism. But we can determine again what we are dealing with when, in inner pictures, we bring up from the depths the very event we have experienced. If we find our way into how we have the memory picture, how we have a rather vivid memory picture within us, when we remember for a longer period of time something we have experienced, then we learn from having this memory picture what is necessary for meditation, for the foundational meditation of the anthroposophical method of research. For this, what is necessary is that we place an easily understandable and simple mental picture at the center of our consciousness. It does not matter whether that mental picture relates to something external, or whether it is formed exclusively internally, perhaps even just from fantasy. Initially, the truth content of what we imagine does not matter. What matters is rather that we can easily understand it. I described all of these things regarding the anthroposophical method of research in my books title, Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, and title, An Outline of Esoteric Science, as well as in other books. There I described how one can enter into this form of meditative imagining in the soul, much as one delves into mathematics. You will think it absurd, then, when people compare this soul activity, which goes beyond the realm of mathematics and is still pervaded through and through by the will, with something hallucinatory or something subconscious. That is precisely the reason why so much is given by way of a mathematical preparation for anthroposophy. For this is how we come to realize that we have a free hand in creating mental pictures and holding on to them in our consciousness. And people who say that what anthroposophy seeks regarding the inner will could be an hallucination clearly do not go, either deliberately or because of their inability, into the whole way in which this meditative life is actually conducted. That is, people don't address how we make sure to focus our consciousness initially on simple mental pictures, so as not to draw up some reminiscences from our subconscious. By doing this, however, we engage in an activity by means of inner strength and with an effort of the will that we otherwise only engage in because external facts prompt us to. After all, usually based on external facts and experiences, we go on and let the life of mental pictures run its course. But now, in anthroposophical meditation, we free ourselves from those external facts and experiences. Of course, I can only indicate this in principle, and you can find the details in the books I mentioned. What matters now is that we hold on to those mental pictures by means of our inner will, and thus call forth lastingly a soul activity that is usually sparked only by external facts and bound to our outer life, runs its course within us. By continuing to develop this kind of meditation increasingly, by practicing 4 years to hold on to simple mental pictures and to make them permanent, by thus coming to know that soul activity which tears loose our thinking that is now elevated beyond ordinary existence, from the bodily nature, we rise to what I described in the books I mentioned as imaginative cognition. These are not fanciful notions, no fantasies. Imaginative cognition is a condition in which our consciousness is filled with images that are present in our soul in the same way as mathematical constructions and formulas are present. And in the free handling of the reality beyond the senses, a reality we can distinguish from any physical reality just as easily as we distinguish between the triangle we can draw with full inner consciousness on the blackboard as a mere symbol and the purely spiritual concept of the triangle. If we can then persevere with this imaginative life of the soul for a while, we come to know the life of the soul as something that can indeed break free from the body. As we will only fully realize when we engage in such exercises, our ordinary life is bound to our nervous system and the rest of our organism. We come to realize that our soul spiritual life runs its course independently of the organism, and that this soul spiritual life can be filled with images. Only in this way do we come to know the meditative life. These images filling our soul spiritual life are much like memory images. They are not hallucinations. It is not true that we are filled with hallucinations or visions when we engage in anthroposophical research. Rather, it is precisely through the presence of memory that we learn the new type of contents in which the images of imaginative cognition or imaginative consciousness emerge. At the same time, we then also know that when those images appear, we can no longer say, quote, "I imagine, therefore I am not," close quote, which is what we can say when we are thinking. Now, when I have advanced to imaginative cognition, I encounter in a strange way what I had initially come to know in the external world, namely, necessity. I can form my images in imaginative cognition, but relative to the new world that now emerges, I cannot jumble the images and move them around this way and that arbitrarily. Rather, I gradually find myself compelled to relate the images that emerge for me in my imaginative life to a new world I am coming to know, to a spiritual world. In the process, I am learning this image that I have initially prepared, I must then place as a question in connection to some fact of the spiritual world. And through this image that I built up myself, I thus enter into a relationship with this spiritual world. Through the consciously created images of imaginative cognition, I come into a spiritual world much like I come into an interrelationship with the outer world of the senses, by way of the images that my eyes create or the sound images that my ears produce. These latter images that are created in eyes and ears are produced without any arbitrary input on my part. But the world of images that is produced in the imagination is attained only after such an intensive schooling as I have described it in the books I mentioned, namely titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, among others. Through this schooling, we gain the opportunity to offer something, to offer an inner activity to the spiritual world. Just as our senses in the activity of the eyes and of the ears can offer something to the external natural world, so that we receive images of that world. In other words, what is to give us insights into the spiritual world must first be developed in us, must first be drawn up from the depths of the soul. And that happens in the first stage of suprasensory knowledge, in imaginative consciousness. But it is important that we then enter into a sort of necessity. And we now really come to know what freedom actually is. You see, people who have hallucinations or visions are creating images out of their physical body. They only follow an inner necessity, an inner compulsion. But people who live in their fantasy produce images out of their soul, and they are more or less conscious of how they create these images. And when they are healthy and are not insane, they know full well that they are living in an unreal fantasy world. We always know regarding what we produce in our imaginative consciousness that these images are what we ourselves have created. Because after all, our ordinary normal consciousness, the consciousness that experiences itself in freedom, is still there. We know that those images are our own creations. Just as we know this about the formulas we have created in mathematics in order to comprehend reality. At the same time, however, we also know that as we enter into the spiritual world, we grasp that world with those images. That is, we see that as human beings we can understand this process with our usual outer consciousness. We have in our ordinary life and in the traditional sciences the possibility of gaining freedom for ourselves. And because we realize that mere mental picturing is not in reality, we have to say, I think, therefore I am not. Cogito ergo non sum. When we develop our freedom with this kind of thinking and then look back into the spiritual world, we look back into a world in which that necessity prevails, which we have first come to know in the outer world. In the outer world, we take the necessity of facts for granted. From there, we advance into a kind of thinking where, in a sense, freedom pushes back the certainty of inner thinking. From this free kind of thinking, we move on to imagining, which also lays claim to having an existence. And so we arrive again in a world of necessity. But we arrive in this world of necessity in an inner way, and in this way we learn above all to see through that about which people often speak, but which we encounter always only in a certain nebulous negative, mystical way. For it is only when we come to know the imaginative consciousness I have described that self-observation first becomes possible. I want to put it like this. What used to give us a foothold in the I, capital, while we were looking into the not I, that foothold now begins to become brighter. The will enters into it and begins to take hold of it, and we feel ourselves once again in a world of necessity. This is how we arrive at self-awareness. If you then continue with your exercises, you will arrive at an exercise where you can make the images disappear just as much as you can make them arise within you. Indeed, it is essential to be able to do this. Without this, we cannot become masters over what is happening, and instead become visionaries, not spiritual researchers. When we reach the point where we are able to make those images disappear again, we will have reached the level where our will is fully active within us in this world of images, and we can then erase the very image whose becoming we have experienced in our soul. And that is the moment in which we enter what I have called the second stage, namely inspired consciousness. Please don't take offense at the expression. After all, we have to use terms as technical aids, so to speak. I have used that term following old expressions, but the fact is that it is indeed a new one. That is, the old term now refers to a fact I have researched myself, namely the new inspired consciousness. That's what I mean by that term. It is with this inspired consciousness that we then stand within spiritual reality. Once we stand in this spiritual reality truly in such a way that it fully envelops us as a world of spiritual beings, then we also see the soul in its true being. And then what Anthroposophy describes becomes an immediate fact for us, namely the fact of repeated earthly lives. We see the soul as it moves from one life to the next, and through the life in between. That is, the life between death and a new birth. In other words, we can see the path of the soul. By that point, we have in a sense expanded our mental picturing so that it can essentially turn inward and move in the opposite direction from that of our memory images. Let us ask how memory-based mental picturing moves. As I mentioned, first of all, we have the experience that we are in relationship to the outer world. We live within it with our whole being, enter with our whole being into some event in the outer world. This then speaks to our will impulses, or better said, it speaks to our feeling. It also speaks to our mental picturing. We live with our whole being in that experience. Perhaps we even exert physical effort in having the experience. In short, we live in the experience with our whole being. Our soul, thereby, descends, in that we have our mental pictures, into the depths, and then we can call it forth again in the image. In other words, we can say that in our ordinary experience of events, we move from the outer experience to the ordinary memory, because the outer images undergo a certain inner metamorphosis. But in meditating, which is what we are dealing with in anthroposophical research, we proceed in the opposite direction. We first learn to have the image that must not be connected directly to an outer experience or subconscious reminiscence of one. Instead, we learn to advance not to an outer experience, but to a supra-sensory experience, and also to experiences that precede our birth or our conception. In this way, we come to know the pre-existence of the soul, the spiritual essence of our soul, in the same way we ordinarily come to know what our outer experiences have offered us, at least up to a certain point in our childhood. But it is the opposite experience which leads us to spiritual experience, where we begin from the image and ascend to the experience. If at the same time we exercise a certain self-discipline, namely the kind of self-discipline that works into our outer actions more and more out of what we know in ordinary life as the feeling of love, then we can objectively come to know how, in the tasks the outer world presents to us, we can develop our actions in love. When we come to know that life in the outer world, then our progress from the image to reality will gradually be such that from the imaginative consciousness we move on through the inspired consciousness to intuitive consciousness. That is, we learn to stand within the inner objectivity, within the inner necessity of the spiritual world. Ladies and gentlemen, in the natural sciences, you see, necessity is our starting point. In the natural sciences, we approach the human being in such a way that we can only contribute something in our thinking if we have kept within us what we have researched in the way of the outer natural sciences. And if we can say to ourselves that in order to be truly human, we carry something within us that is connected to the being of the world as a whole. But in the attempt to approach human beings with the kind of thinking that can be applied extraordinarily well out there in the natural sciences, out there in our outer life, we now enter into a region. I have characterized it in more detail in my title, Philosophy of Freedom, and you can read about it there, where we cannot get any further. The hypotheses become uncertain. However, when we further develop what can be experienced in the area of freedom, then we come into the objectivity of the spirit in the opposite direction. And in that process, it can be very helpful if in the Goethean sense, as Goethe explained this in his natural scientific writings, we do not use thinking to conjure up hypotheses, but simply to bring the phenomena together. When we arrange phenomena, we learn how we are to approach this world. With this approach, we do not arrive at the realm of atoms. We do not get to atoms or electrons and so on, elements that are justified to a certain extent insofar as the outer appearance of things is concerned. And with the approach of physical science in general, we arrive only at the outer appearance of things. But if we consider these purely as phenomena, then we can advance to what stands behind the phenomena, namely that to which we and the eternal core of our being also belong. That is, we can then advance to the realm of imagination, inspiration, and intuition. In this way, we also come to gain a certain self-knowledge and to implement what we demand in self-observation. Thus, by developing our imaginative consciousness, we learn how to look into ourselves. After all, what is our memory based on? Essentially, the basis of our memory is that we capture, in images, what we experience in the outer world. Not as is the case, for example, in the first days of our childhood, when what we experience is sent down into our bodily organization, but in such a way that what we experience is mirrored, in a certain way, reflected, as though our organization were a mirror on which we capture, insofar as we recall our experiences, the memory images of those experiences. As we thus develop our memory, which we need for a healthy social and scientific life, we also overcome, through anthroposophical research, the restriction to our physical organization. But in this process, our ordinary consciousness must always be present. That is, we must not proceed as in hallucinations. Rather, as we advance to imaginative consciousness, we must also always remain sensible people, always have our ordinary consciousness involved in the process. That is what makes this imaginative or inspired mental picturing completely different from hallucination. Hallucinations and visions live in what comes forth from the body. As a result, when we develop bodily images based on our body, we are dealing with visions and hallucinations. When we compose images out of our soul, we are dealing with forms of our fantasy. But once we learn to compose pictures out of the spirit, having learned to be active, purely soul spiritually, free from the body, then this is a spiritual reality. Thus you see that it is the body that generates images through hallucinations and visions. The soul composes images by arriving not at visionary images, but fantasies. The spirit within us is what composes images by approaching spiritual realities. When we now look backward within ourselves, so to speak, we look through the mirror, just as though we were piercing through or removing the back layer from a real mirror, and looking through the mirror to what lies behind it. And as we do this, what we encounter within ourselves is not what the nebulous mystics chatter about. Rather, something very different comes toward us there. For our soul has experienced much before it believes itself to be uniting with some kind of deity within us. People talk about divine manifestations in the human eye, capital. They chatter about all kinds of things they dream up. But those who approach their inner life with real spiritual science find something very different. They are able to see materially what is otherwise given in their soul. Usually what is given to us, known to us in our soul, is our thinking, our feeling, our willing, our wishes, our desires. Now, we can look through everything that we generally feel to be more or less connected with our memory, and we see into the actual inner lawfulness of our organism. We truly get to know our organism. This means that we will not ramble on and on the way nebulous mystics do, but instead we will talk about the actual nature of our liver, lungs, and stomach, whose actual nature we come to know through this inner perception. We can add our inner perception to what we know from conscientious, ordinary physical anatomy. As you see, this gives us the opportunity to advance to a real science of pathology. There you see that the spiritual science that does not turn toward nebulous, rambling mysticism, but rather proceeds on the basis of exact methods, can actually enter into the entire realm of the sciences. Indeed, we learn quite a bit more. Above all, we come to realize that even in the case of mystics that seem so great, such as St. Teresa or Mechtild of Magdeburg, there were abnormal bodily conditions involved. In other words, we learn that there can be abnormal functioning of the liver, for example, or of the spleen, or other organs. And out of this incomplete and disharmonious functioning, there can then arise those images that we usually admire so much in mysticism. Ladies and gentlemen, knowledge is something we cannot grasp with prejudices, however beautiful they may be. I believe that those who can make themselves at home in knowledge, in an unprejudiced way, will experience a deeper insight into the ground of being, because they know how the human organism concocts such beautiful things as we encounter in the most noble figures, such as St. Teresa or Mechtild of Magdeburg, when they mystically and nebulously rhapsodize and dream of this and that, which supposedly emerges in a purely soul-spiritual way from within. This is the strange thing here. Through self-observation, we advance to the materiality of the human organism. This is what will increasingly distinguish exact anthroposophy from all the blather and chatter of inner mysticism. Anthroposophy will not lead us into some nebulous realm, but into realities. Exact anthroposophy teaches what cannot be attained through outer anatomy, because what we can know from outer physiology and anatomy is only one side of things. What exact anthroposophy can show is how the soul is pre-existent, and how this soul, out of its more comprehensive being, works into what is being formed in the mother's womb in order to shape that body out of the spiritual realm. In this way, the real develops out of the spiritual world. As we advance with our meditative method, we thus immerse ourselves in the realm of reality. In the fact that the natural sciences approach the human being from the outside world, and the spiritual anthroposophical science, as a complete knowledge of the human being, moves toward the natural realm, we find what allows us to experience that harmony of spirit and matter, which we must experience if we want to be fully human in the complete sense of the word. We reach a point there where, out of an inner urge, actually out of inner feeling and willing, we step directly into knowledge. It follows that without this knowledge, we always feel the need to appeal to an atomistic world, and thus cannot truly grasp the inner nature of the material realm. The more we come to know the real material, the more we come to know the nature of the spiritual from the outside. That is, we actually learn to build a bridge on which we move from knowledge of the spirit to that of matter, and from knowing matter to knowing spirit. Of course, we should not believe that in this way it will be possible to solve all of the world's mysteries at once. Weak-minded people may say that human life today must be tragic, because human beings inevitably run up against the limits of knowledge, limits that make the world's mysteries seem unsolvable to them. This is not the case. When we advance as I have described, and come to know spiritual life as it really is, as it shoots into us like a bolt of lightning, and when we then, on the other hand, encounter the material world, that is, as we meet the world with a true capacity for knowledge, then by ascending to this knowledge, we basically learn to experience something that will not make us lazy where knowledge is concerned. Rather, from what we will experience, we will come to know the struggle in which we as human beings are interwoven. We see then how we live out there in the struggles of spiritual worlds and beings, how we participate in these struggles through the ethical and the religious realms, and how we build our social life out of this struggle. We come to learn something that does not make the condition of the soul more superficial when it comes to solving the world's riddles, but on the contrary deepens it. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is essentially what anthroposophy wants. It is the way to meet the natural sciences. Those who want to oppose anthroposophy from the standpoint of the natural sciences, or following on from the natural sciences from the standpoint of philosophy, are tilting at windmills. For anthroposophy addresses everything that can legitimately be put forth by the natural sciences. Indeed, anthroposophy can accommodate what can be gained from such natural sciences and such philosophy only through its own full knowledge. But this full knowledge was not wanted. As a result of a long time of development, the spiritual life, civilized life as it is nowadays, has attained what is now known as agnosticism. Again and again, thinkers who did not want to advance and develop thinking, who did not want to enter the imaginative, inspired, and intuitive world, have instead spoken of the ignorabimus, or the unbreachable limits of our knowledge. Typically, they have presented something that must be regarded as unknowable, incomprehensible. But since, as human beings, we always know that we are spirit, that we are soul, we would actually have to be able to distinguish our spiritual origin from nebulous mysticism and the like. Everything that amounts to superstition, in the true sense of the word, in the various areas of life, does not originate in anthroposophy, which strives for clarity and transparency, and strives to emulate the exact natural sciences. Instead, the origin of superstitions is to be found in the notion that we cannot and will not know, that is, in agnosticism. This is what created the mysticism with all its blather. It is precisely the notion that we cannot and will not know that leads to agnosticism, because human beings always must seek the spirit. All nebulous fads and movements have their origin in the notion that we cannot know, in agnosticism. Anthroposophy, however, does not want anything nebulous. Anthroposophy wants to be light, to be the continuation of that light, which it recognizes as a light that carries humanity forward, a real spiritual light that anthroposophy also sees in the modern natural sciences. This is how anthroposophy sees the relationships between modern natural sciences, modern philosophy, and itself. The end of Lecture 4.